فقد قال الله سبحانه وتعالى: فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، إنه لا يحب المستكبرين. Last week we introduced the subject of racism in Islam, at least racism in the context of Islamic teaching. We described how a comparison of the respective histories of Islam in the West shows a relative absence of racism in Islam. And we also described how the various ayat of the Quran and the ahadith of the Prophet ﷺ have provided Muslims with an enlightened perspective on human diversity. And also, it can provide constructive insights for our world, which is still plagued with racism. We went on to describe how, if we look at the history of Muslims across more than three continents that spans more than 1,300 years, there have been no lynchings whatsoever throughout our history. There have been no racial segregation laws, no apartheid laws. There have been no legal efforts to differentiate people according to their degree of black blood or unworthy stock. And with Islam, the most dispossessed, the slaves, people of minority racial or ethnic groups have been able to assert their absolute rights as equals with the majority populations amongst whom they've settled. We find in Islamic history, blacks have been able to assert their equality with their white siblings and achieve positions of power as well and respect that until recently were way beyond what has been achieved in Europe and North America and Australia. Also, we talked about how racism and bigotry and chauvinism, claims of superiority based on physical characteristics, are in fact shaitani, they are satanic in origin. And we took the opportunity of exploring those few ayat in the Quran which relate to the incident of the refusal of shaitan to bow down and yield to Adam alayhi salam. His arrogance, his haughtiness holding him back, his prejudice. As Muslims, our opposition to racism and support for equality and harmony are absolute. The Quran affirms it categorically, and the ahadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam are unequivocal. Unfortunately, in Australia, we find ourselves in the grip of one racial panic after another, and this, as we mentioned last week, has been fostered by successive administrations which are intent on conjuring these homegrown threats to freedom. And this dubious racist Islamic terrorism narrative or threat of an Islamic invasion of Muslims overrunning the country is no more than a means of ensuring total submission to despotic power, more often than not foreign power. And it does so by dividing the human family into us and them. And this is all fostered in this climate of fear, in this climate of anger and suspicion. And this is where we'll continue today, using the fiasco that is Pauline Hanson and the One Nation Party as a point of reference. There's an interesting individual called George Fredrickson. He was the professor of history at Stanford University, and his academic speciality was racism. He observed that in the late 19th century, Germany, which found itself in the grip of the religious and racial panic that was anti-Semitism, the hatred of the Jew. In that period in Germany, an anti-Semitic party emerged in the election of 1881, and its call to the German population was that of the expulsion or the marginalization of the Jewish community. Its success, as George Fredrickson describes, was engineered in fact from above, as the conservatives, the more mainstream political entities in Germany, were using hostility to the Jews to lure the middle-class voters away from the liberals. At that point in time, the conservatives and the liberals were competing for the popular vote. As a consequence, in the 1890s, a more spontaneous and populist anti-Semitism emerged in Germany. The conservatives decided to incorporate that anti-Semitic appeal that had been worked up within the German mindset into the conservative program, and eventually to absorption of that anti-Semitic line those single one issue parties, those anti-Jewish parties, effectively were absorbed into the mainstream conservative agenda. Fredrickson then concludes, taking that as a case in point, like the Democrats in the southern United States, Germany's conservatives learned that racism could be used, to quote him, whenever expedient or necessary, to steal the thunder of their populist rivals and keep themselves in firm control. So what we find happening in Germany in that period was almost exactly what we find happening today. That was an example of the use of racism by a respectable mainstream political party, a conservative party, which, as we know, sowed a poisonous legacy for Germany, which ultimately culminated in the slaughter of the Jewish population of Germany. If we look at Pauline Hanson, I'll just go back 20 years, when she was kicked out of the Liberal Party in 1996 for offensive comments about Aboriginal people, she was drawing on a long and sordid history that we can actually trace back even in our modern context to the rise of Nazi Germany. In 1997, Pauline Hanson, feeling off the racism of almost 200 years, claimed that Aboriginal people were cannibals. They killed and ate their own women and children, she's quoted to have said. Now, there were many other absurdities that unfortunately spewed from the mouth of Pauline Hanson, but these views may seem like an anomaly, racism on the extreme end of the spectrum, and that it should be confined to the fringes of society. But the fact is that Australia's racist history, its justification for killing Aboriginal men and women and children, for stealing land and stealing children, and stealing wealth and stealing resources, were all actually based on racist tropes exactly like this, which Pauline Hanson, unfortunately, to her discredit, shamelessly revived. White Australia, and everyone who in fact comes to this country, including me and you, benefits in some way from the assault on the Aboriginal people and their culture. And this was justified by the likes of Pauline Hanson and her predecessors. Now these tropes, these caricatures, including the trope of the Aboriginal mother as an infanticidal cannibal who would not hesitate to eat her own children, which is obviously a lie, it was used to dehumanize Aboriginal people, to paint them as savages, and as a consequence to justify the stealing of their land and cement the fiction that this was terra nullius. This was an empty land, populated just by primitives or intermediate species, which is what the Aboriginals were referred to. The idea that primitive people were cannibals, in fact, was in settlers' minds even before they arrived on the shores of Australia. And this became the catalyst which made it possible for the Aboriginal people to be dehumanized by the colonizing European peoples, and then lead to their very swift elimination or attempt at elimination. This demeaning trope has been recirculated, unfortunately, throughout the history of this land. And the last person to say this, the last incarnation of this caricature of the Aboriginal, was yours truly, Pauline Hanson. Now, the problem with these is that racism becomes ingrained when these caricatures, these tropes, these mocking, disparaging attitudes are repeated. Of course, you'd never see a mainstream party, a mainstream political party, a conservative party, a liberal party, repeating outrageous claims like this. And yet, much like the German conservatives, the German mainstream almost 100 years before, that eventually led to the rise of Hitler and the slaughter of the Jewish population, including the Poles, the Gypsies, and almost 70 million European lives were lost as a consequence of that type of chauvinism, that racism. And what's sad is that this new form of racism is more insidious, because it's painted as sensible, and then it's sold to the public. And this is effectively what is happening in Australia today. So if you compare Pauline Hanson's maiden speech in the Howard years, you see the seeds of Hanson's racist thinking, in fact, becoming a prelude to the policies, in fact, of the mainstream conservative parties of that day. And we find it reflected throughout the policies of John Howard, in fact, towards the First Nation people. So So if you look at Pauline Hanson's speech to Parliament almost 20 years ago, Hanson called for the abolition of ATSIC. Now, ATSIC, for those of you who have been here long enough, was the attempt at involving the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the process of governing their own affairs, their own local and their own indigenous affairs. So Pauline Hanson called for the abolition of ATSIC. In 2004, the Howard government then put that plan into action. So what was dismissed as the absurdities of a right-wing fringe, in fact, softened the ground and the mindset within mainstream Australian society to accept what effectively was the plan of the Howard government. Another example, Hanson led an outright attack in that maiden speech on Aboriginal land rights and a native title. Howard then began his plans to whittle down native title. And this was spurred on by powerful mining and pastoral interests. And if you look at our own Tony Abbott, we see that coming to pass even in northern Western Australia. And we find multiple examples of how the absurd policy recommendations of Pauline Hanson become the mainstream policies of the conservative governments. The scare campaigns around the Aboriginal land rights and native title from the Hawke era through to Keating and Howard by mining and industry lobbies, in fact, helped cement this racism. And it paved the way for the acceptance of outrageous views like Hanson's. The claims of Pauline Hanson that Aboriginal people get special privileges was another example. And this laid the groundwork for the disastrous policy era, which still dominates thinking till today, whereby the rights of Aboriginal people have been whittled away in the face of a call to diminish their privileges. There are very few privileges. So what we find is that by accepting and normalizing this racist, bigoted attitude at the bottom, in fact, excuses the equally vicious racism at the top. And this is effectively what has been happening through Australian politics for a very, very long time, and is unfortunately being used as a stock standard formula in this very day. The only difference between yesteryear and now, we are the target of that racism. So we find this vicious racism at the top from both the major parties, both the Labour and the Liberal, and also the sidelining of the role of big corporations in promoting racism for their own self-interest, effectively has become the reality that pervades Australia today. Using that example of Germany from 100 years ago, just like we had in Germany then, the mainstream parties, the mainstream conservative parties, reclaimed the voters of the smaller racist party then. Equally, what we find today is that this anti-Muslim sentiment did not begin with Pauline Hanson. In fact, we shouldn't be furrowing our brows at her outrageous, blatant racism. A more sophisticated anti-Muslim sentiment was used to justify the mandatory indefinite detention of Muslim asylum seekers during the Abbott era, for example. It was used to justify the torture of Australian citizens in Guantanamo. It was used to justify illegal wars in Muslim countries like Iraq and like Afghanistan and Libya and currently Syria. And don't forget the proxy wars in places like Yemen. It was also used to justify our government's support for Israel's subjugation of the Palestinians, the very same racist trope. It's also used to justify Western support for murderous tyrants in Muslim countries who oppress their Muslim citizens like Sisi in Egypt. So there's a lot of anti-Muslim argument that has come from the need of those who are in power to defend their anti-Muslim policies or their aggressive policies towards Muslim nations. Now, One Nation, Pauline Hanson's party, was wiped out for almost 20 years. And the reason why it was wiped out is because the mainstream parties like the Liberals stole their agenda. So the lesson of the 1990s was that the real danger is in fact the mainstream. We shouldn't be distracted by Pauline Hanson. She's just a red herring, very much like we as Muslims are red herrings when it comes to the open onslaught on Australian liberties and Australian civil rights and rule of law by foreign powers, in fact. Unfortunately, there are elements within our government that are too willing to prostitute themselves to foreign power. But having said that, the real danger is really the mainstream parties, which, in fact, legitimized Pauline Hanson's views. It lays the groundwork, for example, for our current coalition, stealing her policies and, in fact, regaining her votes. The right wing, in fact, will very swiftly become part and parcel of the mainstream liberal coalition. We'll see within the next few years. So the likes of Pauline Hanson are dangerous. They're dangerous because, firstly, they're a bit of a red herring, they're a bit of a detraction or distraction from what is really happening by those who truly enjoy decision-making power in Australia. But also because her views present a subtle process of redefining the values of Australian people and re-engineering society effectively. So if you look at the recent polls of more than 48 or 45% of Australians supporting the ban on Muslim migration, this is an example of re-engineering of the societal values, or should I say, absence of values. I'm a little suspicious about those statistics, to be quite honest. They were taken only over, I think, a participation of 1,000 individuals. But having said that, it's definitely cause for concern. Pauline Hanson's rhetoric delineates new boundaries of racism. In fact, it pushes the boundaries of hate speech. If you look at the appearance of Pauline Hanson on ABC's Q&A, immediately after that, the day after, radio broadcasters and many talk shows threw open the question of whether Australia should ban Muslim immigration. And that has, in fact, become the talk of the day till now. What is, I think, strange is that the very racist nature of this question was lost on the callers who perceived it now as part of legitimate debate, because the powers that be, our politicians and representatives, have legitimized it. Pauline Hanson, you could say, sort of like the sharp tip of the spear. Also lost on many of the callers, Australian callers, was the fact that the overwhelming majority of the victims of terrorist attacks across the world are Muslims, more than 97%. So an entire parallel universe, to quote John Kerry, has been created for the Australian public, reconfiguring of values, or should I say, stripping away of values. We really don't have a Muslim problem in Australia. Since 9/11, which is pretty iconic for most Westerners, quite absurd for most Muslims, more than 3,000 Australian women, for example, have lost their lives at the hands of Australian men as a consequence of domestic abuse and violence in their own homes. One in every three Australian girls will be a victim of sexual molestation or abuse before her 18th birthday. Only two Australians have been killed as a consequence of so-called Islamic terrorism on Australian soil. So we can already see how the priorities have shifted and how the Muslim problem has been exaggerated and how racism has made that possible. So in Australia, we really have a racism problem, but it's not simply racism for its own sake. In terms of foreign policy, Australia is a run-on team or a Gurkha for America and Israel. It's just that supporting tyranny to get a cheap oil while at the same time furthering Israel's regional expansionist agenda comes with a backlash. The people of those lands naturally will react and protest. The only way to explain this backlash to, in fact, what is a war-weary Australian society, war-weary voters, is radical Islam. So you're shifting the attention away from disastrous, in fact, criminal foreign policy to radical Islam. So radical Islam in the Middle East is abstract, and it's presented by an editing suite to our living rooms, and the average Australian consumes this trash. To stop criticism of failed, like I said, and criminal government policy, Australia, or at least we should say those within government, need radical Islam in our own backyard. They do need this red herring. And here we find One Nation and Pauline Hanson entering, and a good many others, not only here, but they replicate it in every other country that's on Team America. We find foreign interest, American foreign interest, becomes the primary determinant or dictator of what happens on the ground in Australia. So Muslims are the same as the communists of the past. There's a new McCarthyism, for those of you who remember the communist era. And for exactly the same reasons, to detract attention away from the egregious criminal behavior of Western governments like the United States, and unfortunately our own government, who has capitulated to American foreign policy. Now, the reason why I thought it's important for us to discuss this in our Jummah khutbah is firstly to afford Muslims a position which they could hold and thereafter convey to their non-Muslim friends. It's important that we have an opinion. It's important that we do not remain silent, at least with those with whom we come into contact with on a daily basis. Within our sphere of influence, it's important for us to express our concern, but also to have a legitimate argument, an intelligible criticism. Secondly, it's important for us to not just be overly focused or concerned about our own well-being, our own rights, our own liberties, but also the well-being and the rights and the liberties of all Australians. It's important that we articulate it in a way that they can understand. If we can call to their history, Nazi Germany still being a very conspicuous point of reference for most Australians, something that they still are quite abhorred by. And it can be a very interesting point of reference for them whereby they can begin to understand our concerns in this country and also our concerns for them particularly. We have to do as we've said 1,000 times over in our bayans here. We cannot withdraw altogether. We need to ensure that we engage constructively and not react to what happens out there, but engage constructively. Try to influence those that are closest to us. We need to at least introduce ourselves to our neighbors. Take a box of chocolates to your neighbors. Introduce yourself. If each and every one of us, every single Muslim, could establish just an affectionate or at least a mutually respectful relationship with their neighbors in Australia, 90% of the battle for the hearts and minds of Australian people will be won. We can at least humanize ourselves in the eyes of our neighbors. We need to introduce them to Islam and give them literature if we find ourselves reluctant to want to speak or engage in some type of discussion about Islam. At least hand out booklets on Islam to our friends and neighbors and our colleagues at work. We also need to participate in the political processes. We need to vote and vote for parties that reflect our concerns. We also need to participate in the political processes. We need to groom our children not just to be lawyers or doctors or engineers or accountants, but also to be politicians. And we do have the means whereby we can allow our children access into the corridors of power. So we need to consider at least one child in a family. By that, I'm talking about an extended family who could participate in the political processes, whether those are local or national political platforms. We also need to attend at least our school board meetings, become part of the local school council. This is another way in which we can express our concerns, at the very least, humanize ourselves in the eyes of those who live with us. We also need to submit our opinion pieces to the newspapers. Many of us, alhamdulillah, Allah is gifted with the ability to articulate themselves. Those amongst us who write well, those of us who have a wealth of experience from countries where we've seen society implode because of this type of foolishness, express our concerns and write to the newspapers regularly. I was about to say something which I thought may be inappropriate, but even Theodor Herzl, and we shouldn't be taking our lessons from the Zionists, unfortunately the most repulsive of humanity, but he said noise is everything. The more noise you make, and by that I'm not talking about the type of absurdities that we sometimes see in the media, but intelligent voices, intelligent opinions. We need also to invite local officials to our masjids. Unfortunately, we don't have a masjid, and I feel that our contribution in Canning Vale is inhibited by the fact that we don't have a masjid, whereby we can invite our local politicians to our masjids, invite the local school principals, for example, the local church leaders, and in this way break down those barriers. So the next time they hear Pauline Hanson, they see it for the absurdity it is. We need to also host public events. Whatever those public events are, the Eid Carnival was one example, but we need different types of public events. And those public events should span the full spectrum of culture and arts and philosophy and science and technology. And Muslims, we know once upon a time, were at the cutting edge of every discipline. It's important that we become advocates of those very disciplines and have our names associated with the genuine desire and intent to see humanity progress. Obviously, not progress for its own sake, and by that I don't mean merely economic advancement, but moral and spiritual advancement as well. We also need to get ourselves involved in our local masjids. Now, unfortunately, we only have one local masjid, which is the Southern River Masjid. So we need to somehow make time to go over there, or any other masjid of our choosing, but become part and parcel, at least, of our own community first and see where we can contribute. We also need to engage the media. As simple as picking up a telephone in a talkback radio program. And I know at least half a dozen young Muslims who are actively involved in the media. We need to expand that. So there's so much more we can do in our own personal capacity as an organized community. And there is no way out for us but to do that, to constructively engage. At the very least, our colleagues at work and our neighbors. Invite the neighbors over for meals and speak to your colleagues. Invite them over for meals as well. Be like the great host Ibrahim alayhi salam. The distinctive feature of the da'wah of Ibrahim alayhi salam is that he would soften hearts first before communicating the message. And the easiest way to soften a heart is to feed. He would have people as guests in his home, feed them, and then communicate his message. So that's a simple thing each and every one of us can do. And our food is definitely the best. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant us tawfiq and the wisdom to meet the challenges that we face. We shouldn't be too despondent. In fact, what is happening is part of Allah's broader plan. وَمَكَرُوا وَمَكَرَ اللَّهِ They plan, Allah plans. وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الْمَاكِرِينَ And Allah is the best of planners. Ultimately, the end is for the righteous. وَآخِرُ دَعْوَانَا أَنِ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ